Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiffs, Henry Feinberg et al., in a case against RM Acquisition. The ERISA law was enacted to protect contractually defined benefits, and the legislative history of the statute makes it clear that the purpose of the statute was to protect individual pension rights. Yet the ruling below denies that protection to the plaintiffs and deprives the plaintiffs of a promise that was made to them by their employer, which secured their employment, their retention, and
You didn't sue the employer, though.
We didn't sue the employer because we did sue the employer, but we're not proceeding against the employer.
And the employer.
The employer has no assets. The transaction in this case was structured in a way to deprive the employer of the assets in an attempt.
The problem I have with your case is that you really haven't made a case. You haven't told us anything about the bankruptcy, and you haven't shown that this transaction where the successor corporation acquires some assets, some liabilities, but leaves other liabilities with the shell. You haven't shown this was fraudulent conveyance or some other kind of fraud. You haven't told us anything. For all we know, or all I know, this is a very common type of transaction. Buy assets from a company. You don't automatically assume their liabilities.
Well,
what's going on here?
We are at the motion to dismiss stage. We have not been able to take.
Now, under Iqbal and Twombly, you have to in your complaint. You have to do enough of a pre-complaint investigation to make the court think that there's probably something bad there if you can prove the facts. But all the facts you have is that they didn't take the liability with them. RM didn't acquire the liability, so your client is out of luck.
Well, there are.
What else have you shown?
There are additional facts, Your Honor. We have pled and we have attached the plan document to the complaint showing that RM Acquisition succeeded to the role of plan administrator in this plan by operation of law.
That's not true because it didn't take the plan with it.
But that's the allegation that we've made, that the contractual agreement between Rand McNally and RM Acquisition was structured in a way to defeat that expectation and defeat the promise that was set forth in the plan.
Whatever they defeated, RM did not become a plan administrator because it doesn't have the plan. It can't be the administrator.
And that's why we didn't pursue.
The administrator is your shell, right? Rand McNally, which you haven't sued.
Rand McNally is without assets, and the only way that the plaintiffs can secure the promises that were made to them is to pursue RM Acquisition, which has the assets that were to have been used
for. The problem with these ERISA plans from an employee's standpoint is that apart from vested rights, the plan sponsor can change the plan at will. Right? And then you're out of luck. You have no rights.
But that couldn't occur in this case because of the provision in the plan relating to amendment and termination, Article 4 of the plan, which makes it quite clear that no amendment or termination of the plan may adversely affect the plan benefits, which would be payable to any person eligible to receive benefits under the plan prior to the effective date of the amendment.
It wasn't terminated. It just wasn't transferred to RM.
No, we allege.
If you want to show it's a. Pardon?
We allege that the plan was terminated, Your Honor. That's alleged in the amended complaint.
But liability for whatever breach there was of those plan terms doesn't run to RM. That's the problem here.
But that's the allegation that we've made, that Section 510 of ERISA is the only potential remedy that plaintiffs have. ERISA preempts the field. So we have to structure a claim under ERISA, or this becomes an absolutely meaningless promise that was made by the employer.
510 doesn't fit your case, because 510, at best, putting aside the question whether it's just for employees, but if it's not just, to protect the employment relationship, can't fire a person in order to divest him of his rights. If it's not, if there's more than that, still you have to show discrimination. What's the discrimination here?
The discrimination was the economic retaliation against
the
plaintiffs.
That's not discrimination. What is the discrimination means you're treating someone more favorably than someone else. So what's the discrimination?
Well, one aspect of the discrimination is that all the other plans survived the asset sale.
Sure, but you describe this plan as something, you know, this is for the highly compensated people. So they kept the plans for the lowly compensated? Is that what they did? They just get rid of the executives who have these gold-plated plans? Is that discrimination?
Effectively, Rand McNally remained in operation, continued with the employees that they had, yet the highly compensated employees who had given service to the company and were made these promises were divested of their benefits. And under the cases that we've cited from the Sixth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit...
Why did they not take this plan? Why did they not assume this liability but assume the other liabilities?
Without discovery, we have no idea. We value the potential liability of this asset at $4 million. The bankruptcy proceeding valued it at $1.8 million. It's not a huge asset considering the size of this asset sale. But without discovery, at the motion to dismiss phase, we're precluded from learning more about why this was done.
Your client doesn't have any idea?
No. Our clients were no longer employed by Rand McNally at the time that this transaction occurred.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bauke, is this what is commonly considered a top hat plan?
Yes.
Aren't those plans mainly in the nature of deferred compensation for highly paid people?
They are, and they're subject to ERISA with none of the advantages of the ERISA vesting rules.
Right.
And that's the problem that we have.
What Congress included, whether or not you and I might agree on the appropriate fairness, isn't that the statutory mandate?
So, unfortunately, we're stuck with ERISA preemption of a suit to set aside a fraudulent conveyance, leaving us only with what ERISA offers us, which is why we've chosen to plead under 29 U.S.C. Section 1140 because it's enforceable under 29 U.S.C. Section 1132A3, which the Supreme Court described in Verity as the catch-all that picks up any of these other situations intended to prevent a remedies vacuum. And it's effectively the only cause of action that we have. It would be meaningless for us to pursue a plan which has been terminated because there's no assets there and the plan has been terminated.
Are you saying there's no, you can't have fraudulent, an ERISA beneficiary can't argue that a transaction is a fraudulent conveyance? There's no fraud provision in ERISA?
There is no fraud provision in ERISA. We're stuck with the remedies available under Section 502A of ERISA, 29 U.S.C. Section 1132A. There is no specific fraud provision.
Well, how's that different from 5? I thought we were talking about 510. What's 502A?
502.
General provision on enforcing benefits?
502A is the general remedies provisions of ERISA. This court ruled in a case called Toll versus Carroll Touch, issued in 1992 at 977 Fed Second 1129. That a Section 510 claim is made enforceable through Section 502A3 and E of ERISA. E is the provision that gives the district court's jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction. But 502A3 is the provision that was described by the Supreme Court as the catch-all to remedy situations where there is no other remedy.
So why are you putting all your marbles in 510?
Because... we have no other specific claims. We don't have a claim under 1132A1B because this isn't a claim that we can bring against the plan. The plan has been terminated. This circuit has held a 502A1B claim can only be brought against the plan. A 502A2 claim is a claim brought on behalf of a plan. 502A3 is the catch-all for potentially for breach of fiduciary duty, but...
Well, what if the way you're arguing it, or the way you started, you said, well, Rand McNally had promised these people would have these benefits for life, wouldn't be terminated. and you say, well, that's been violated. Now, isn't there a remedy for that, quite apart from 510?
If there is, I'm not aware of what remedy would be recognized by this court. I mean, the closest case that we could find, and the reason...
I understand you. If you have a non-terminable ERISA plan, that gives you an entitlement to benefits. So you sue for benefits. You obviously can sue for benefits under ERISA.
But if the plan has been terminated and it's an unfunded plan...
But you said that it can't be terminated. And if it can't be terminated, it hasn't been terminated, and you're owed the benefits. So you just sue for the benefits.
Which we're doing from RM Acquisition, because they're the ones who are holding the assets that would be available to pay those benefits.
Mr. Dabowski, the plan was unfunded, and you seek a constructive trust. What can we put in the trust? I mean, if there's no assets.
Well, you
speak of RM's assets, but what assets are there as far as those placed in the set aside for this fund?
There were no assets that were specifically earmarked to pay these plaintiffs, but presumably for all of these plans, the assets are the ongoing generation of assets by the employer.
So what you should have done was sue Rand McNally, get a judgment saying you're entitled to these benefits, right? And then you say, well, but Rand owes you this money, but it's squirreled it away. It gave it to someone else. It gave it to RM, right? And that's a standard fraudulent conveyance. Doesn't have any, not barred by ERISA.
Oh, I'm going to use the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Can't you? Why couldn't you do that? Get a judgment, and then the judgment is uncollectible because the defendant has fraudulently conveyed its assets to another entity. So you go after the other entity. If it received assets without consideration, now that's constructive fraud. You get a judgment against them.
That would have been one possibility.
I think that's your only possibility, because the way you've done it, you're making 510 do work for which it doesn't seem to have been intended. This is not a discrimination case.
Well, effectively, the reason that we chose 510 was based on the Ninth Circuit Lasar decision.
Everybody in this plan, I don't know, maybe Feinberg is the only person, but everybody in this plan is treated alike, right? It's not discrimination. It's not picking on someone. It's wiping out a plan. Yeah, there are other plans. They're not all wiped out. That doesn't seem to be what 510 is about.
510 is about interfering with the attainment of a benefit. And that's why we chose 510 in this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Dabowski. Mr. Kishari?
May it please the Court. My name is Mark Kishari, along with Barbara Brofsky. We represent RM Acquisition in this appeal. And there really is only one issue left before the Court, as I understand it, because the appellants have conceded that there is no 502A1B claim, and the reason for that concession is because this court's precedent holds that a 502A1B claim can only be brought against the plan. I don't represent the plan. The plan is not a party to this appeal. The plan has been dismissed with prejudice. So there really is no 502A1B claim for this court to consider. The only claim left in the case is ERISA Section 510, and there is no claim under ERISA Section 510 as well, and that is because, as this court has pointed out in its earlier comments, and its decisions confirm, 510 presupposes an employment relationship. It also presupposes discrimination. And the amended complaint in this case alleges neither an employment relationship nor discrimination. This really is a case of a garden variety corporate transaction where the liabilities simply were not purchased by or assumed by my client, and there is nothing in ERISA that would vitiate such a transaction. There is also nothing in the amended complaint. Hasn't happened before, so I apologize, Your Honors. Anyway, there is nothing in the amended complaint that would suggest that this is anything other than an ordinary corporate transaction. And there is nothing in Section 510 that would vitiate such a transaction. So given the allegations in the amended complaint and the absence of anything out of the ordinary and the clear language of Section 510 that would say this doesn't apply, and the fact that the plan liabilities were not assumed by our client, the court should affirm the judgment of the district court.
Is the employment relationship limitation interpretation on Section 510 really a sound one as a matter of statutory interpretation?
Yes. And the reason, Your Honor, is because Section 510 speaks in terms of fire, expel, discriminate, and...
Well, right. Firing obviously entails an employment relationship, but expulsion, not necessarily. That can occur in the union context, right? And this section encompasses activities by unions against plan participants, too, doesn't it?
Well, by unions against, yes. Yes, by if
sure.
Well, there are multi-employer plans, for example, that are administered jointly by employers and unions, and they cannot expel, the union can't use the employment relationship to expel someone from that plan,
right.
For example.
And Section 510 protects beneficiaries as well as participants, and beneficiaries are not usually employees, right?
Right.
Not,
well, that's true.
In the employment relationship, so to the extent that deeming, which is our precedent on this statute or statutory remedy, to the extent that it limits the remedy to the context of the employment relationship, it's too narrow, right?
Well, no. And you have to look at the context of this, Your Honor, because ERISA allows an employer to define the terms of a plan and to define amendment terms and termination terms. An employer can terminate a plan under ERISA.
What if he just says to an employee, what if the plan administrator just says to an employee, you're not doing anything to the employment relationship, he says, I don't like you, so I'm just going to cut you out of a plan.
Well, that's a different situation. That's focusing on someone, and that's...
It certainly fits. The title of the Section 510 is Interference with Protected Rights. That sounds like interference with protected rights.
Well, if it's participant specific, if it is, I don't like you in this plan and I want to prevent you from getting further benefits. There are some cases that say that. That's one story. We don't have any allegation like
I understand, but you argue that, and there's language in some cases that it's only applicable when there's an interference with the employment relationship, like firing a person so he won't vest. But in my example, the employment relationship is unaffected, but you're saying, I don't like you, so I'm going to just cut you out of the plan.
Well, Your Honor, I think a word has to be defined by the other words or the company it keeps. And if you look at 510 as a whole, you know, it talks about...
That doesn't get you far. Look, because it has the separate clause about to discriminate, right? That's much broader than the words that precede it. Anyway, those canons of construction.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, my one last point on this is that if the construction that the plaintiffs are suggesting the court adopt in this case is correct, how could an employer exercise an amendment or termination clause in a plan without violating Section 510?
I don't think we're questioning your general point. It's just the very narrow interpretation of 510 as limited to cases where the defendant is actually disrupting the employment relationship rather than just, and as Judge Sykes pointed out, the beneficiaries who are mentioned in the discrimination clause, they're not even employees usually.
Yeah, well, the context of the whole statute has to be considered, and what the plaintiffs are asking in this case goes far beyond what Section 510 should allow when you consider the right to amend and terminate benefits, which is precisely what happened in this case. And if the court would find that district court erred, then the court would be saying that an amendment or termination clause in a benefit plan is subservient, along with an asset purchase agreement in a bankruptcy context, is subservient to Section 510, and there's no authority for that proposition, and the court should not go there. So for those reasons, the court should affirm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Khashoggi. So, Mr. Dubofsky, how much time does he have? 2 minutes, or if you have anything further?
Just very briefly, as the court has seemingly indicated, this court's interpretation of Section 510 to date has been too narrow. And the section is titled Interference with Protected Rights, and that is what occurred in this case.
Even if we overrule deeming and bring our interpretation of the statute into conformity with the Sixth Circuit's?
Yes.
How do you win?
I'm sorry?
How do you win?
Because this is still clearly an interference with protected rights. The plan indicated that...
There still has to be some discriminatory act against a participant or beneficiary, and the action here was against the plan.
The act was to discriminate against these beneficiaries while favoring beneficiaries of other plans.
But you're suggesting that 510 is violated any time... A sale of assets of one company to another doesn't carry with it all ERISA plan liabilities. They could never. That's pretty far-reaching. Do you have any limiting principle? Is there anything special about this case? It's very common for companies to buy other companies without assuming all their liabilities.
But it's common that when that occurs, that the benefit plans are carried over. In the case of the vested benefit plans, they are going to be carried over, or the plan is going to be terminated and the funds distributed. In this case, the plaintiffs were given this promise. They had given their consideration for the promise, and yet they find themselves without
remedy.
No, the
plan stayed with the old company, right?
But as the Ninth Circuit pointed out in the Lessard case, this is sort of too clever by half, that in structuring the plan this way, they couldn't have done this on their own. So the only way that they could shed this liability
That's
was to
right,
transfer the
asset. That's
right,
but what you're saying is that Rand McNally violated your rights by selling its assets and not requiring that the plan liability goes with it. Your gripe is with Rand McNally. Now, RM is involved because it got the assets. But it seems to me you had to establish first that Rand McNally had done something wrong and then see whether you could obtain relief against a non-innocent recipient of Rand McNally's assets. That's the usual way these things proceed. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Dubofsky and Mr. Khashoggi.